Now that you've got breast cancer, are you scared about what the future might hold? How do you enjoy your life when your world has literally been turned upside down? Is the fear of dying always in the back of your mind? Well, today, I'm going to talk to someone special, and she's been living with terminal breast cancer for over a decade. She's the founder of the charity Copperfeel. She's the author and podcast host of Glittering a Turd. And I know she's an inspiration to so many of you. It could only be Chris Helenga. This is So Now I've Got Breast Cancer, the podcast for anyone who's just been diagnosed. I'm Dr. Liz O'Riordan, the breast surgeon with breast cancer. And I found out the hard way just how little I knew when I suddenly found myself in the chemo chair. It's why I wrote my book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer. There's a lot of bad information out there, and I want to guide you down the right path. So if you've got a question, this show will answer it for you. Getting a diagnosis of breast cancer can be terrifying. And one of the first thoughts that ran through my mind 8 years ago when I found a lump was, am I going to die? And it's often the first question my patients asked me when I told them they needed chemo. You could say it's a ridiculous question to ask, as we were all going to die at some point, but the fear is real. And this week's guest, Chris Helenga, has been living without fear for the last 14 years. She was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer when she was only 23, and she's achieved more in those years than many of us do in a lifetime. Today, she's going to share with us the lessons she's learned along the way about how to live life to the fullest. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you here. I know you're feeling your best at the moment. And I'm sure you've told this story hundreds of times, but for the listeners who don't know you, could you take us back to the beginning and how you were first diagnosed?
Sure. It's actually sometimes good to be asked that question because even I sometimes forget and it's a bit rusty. So it was in 2009, the summer of 2009, just before I had plans to go and be a 23-year-old and travel and work out what I wanted to do with my life. I went to GP because I'd found a lump, and it's quite a large lump and it's quite painful, and my other boob was not lumpy. So I went to GP and they said, well, this is very, very normal, very common for young women to have lumpy boobs. And I thought, that's plural. I've definitely only got one lumpy boob, but fine. You know, I didn't really want to hear that I might have to have some other investigations I didn't want to see any concern on her face because I had plans to go away. So, you know, I said, is there anything I can do to make it less sore and tender? And she said, evening primrose oil. And I thought, okay, I think I can get that from Boots or wherever. I'll take some of that with me to China, because I really wasn't sure where I was going to find that in China. And that was kind of it. And then whilst I was there, the pain and the soreness was getting worse. And, you know, I can't tell if lumps are necessarily getting bigger, but it was already quite big. And I figured it was probably not shrinking. And then came home for Christmas a few months later and decided to go back to a GP and have more of a checkup, because I also needed to work out if I still wanted to stay on this mini pill, progesterone only pill, contraceptive pill. And I saw a different doctor this time, and it was a male doctor, and he said, well, we examined you about your boob 6 months ago, and I'm not concerned. This is still very much a you aged woman problem. So I'm not concerned, and you shouldn't be either. And then I had to go back for the third time because by that point I was waking up with bloodstained T-shirts because I had discharge coming out of my nipple. It's like this bloody orange colour. And then they finally referred me to the breast clinic. And even then, because I'd only just come off the pill, they just said, just come off the pill for a bit, see if that changes anything. The consultant, the surgeon who saw me, said, let's wait 3 weeks to see if anything settles. Obviously nothing settled. And then we went back and he said, okay, well, we can do a mammogram now and a biopsy. We know what happened after that. I didn't get good news. And because I've been having this back pain as well, I thought I'd just put my back out when I was in China. on a night out, it turns out there was a tumor on my lower spine too. And by that point, I couldn't even bend down to pick things up. It was so painful. So their first thought was, since it's already spread, there's less of an urgency to make sure that we get rid of the boob or, you know, eradicate the primary and look at what's causing you the most bother, which I am glad about because I really needed some radiotherapy to my spine. So I got that and that really helped. And then I could start chemotherapy, but they weren't going to give me chemotherapy actually. They were going to give me just tamoxifen tablets. I got a second opinion from the Royal Marsden, who thankfully said, "You're young, you're strong, you can handle this chemotherapy, and then we can shrink this tumour and get it out of you later this year, and then go from there." So that's what we did. Yeah, that's my diagnosis story in a nutshell, basically.
It's quite a story. And looking back, how do you now feel about that time now all these years have passed?
Well, it was obviously the catalyst to me wanting to educate people about how they need to not just believe when a doctor says it's normal for you, you should know what's normal for you.
Mm.
And I wish someone had said to me, just get to know your body from whatever age, young age, when I started to get boobs, basically. And if anything changes, we can talk about it and do something about it. And because I wasn't ever told that, I went into that GP's room thinking, whatever they say is right. I don't really know my body. I don't know my boobs very well. And if they say it's nothing, great. So I am frustrated and I am angry that nothing was done because they could have easily referred me. But I've now had this 14 years and I hear it time and time again. You know?
Yeah.
That people are fobbed off with, you're young, lumpy boobs are normal. And they are in young women. But it doesn't mean that's always the case and that something darker isn't brewing in there. So I think if we all just gave ourselves a better chance to have a better conversation with a doctor, we would stand a better chance of being referred and diagnosed early. So I knew that from the start, and that's why I started Coldfeel from the start, because I just thought it doesn't feel right that young people are led to believe this isn't a disease that happens to them and that they don't have any sense of empowerment about going to the GP, about any changes in their boobs. And every person I spoke to at that point said, why would I need to do that and how do I do that?
Yeah.
It was such a foreign thing to all of my friends. So I thought, well, I've got a lot of time on my hands. I may as well do something about it.
I was going to say, a lot of our listeners might not know what Copperfield is. Can you tell us a bit more about what you started with, you and your twin sister, and where it's got to now?
Sure. So my twin sister Myron and I, I was having chemotherapy at the time, and I couldn't help but think that what happened to me shouldn't happen to other people. Wouldn't it be better if young people were educated on the signs and symptoms of breast cancer and that they are given a better chance of an earlier diagnosis if they just know about these things and feel confident to go and speak to someone about the problems if there are anything that they notice that isn't right for them? So having done a Google search, there is no one targeting young people about this stuff.
No.
There were charities obviously doing great work in the research realm, the support realm, and educating older people to go to their mammograms, because obviously mammograms don't happen until you're a bit older. And I just thought, this doesn't have to be a serious, scary thing either, because we're talking to people who've got no idea, and we're not necessarily saying, you're going to get breast cancer, but if something happens, you're going to be better armed and know what to do. And so that's what we wanted for everyone, all of our friends and all of our peers and all the people that we then started going to at festivals, because that's where Copperfield started, was in a field at a student-only festival where we started talking to people about their boobs and whether or not they checked them in a very brash, no bullshit way.
I just, but I think you have to be, don't you?
You really do, but I just don't even think I'd have the bollocks to do it now. But back then, I was just like, no, nothing matters. Like, this is so important. This is so important. And I don't want to be angry and frustrated for the rest of my life about what's happened to me.
Yeah.
I would prefer to funnel that into something that might be really useful and it might have longevity. There may be another better solution that comes along. Great. I don't think we are necessarily the ones that are going to solve the problem, but we can try.
Yeah. I've got to ask, did you check your breast regularly before you were diagnosed? Because I never did.
No, I did. No.
And you think, no one teaches us. We're not taught it at schools. We're not taught at university. My mum never taught me. I think that's why Copperfield. I remember seeing Copperfield at Latitude thinking this is fantastic. All these young girls are going in, learning what to do, getting their glitter. It really is life changing.
It's amazing what glitter can do.
Oh, I know. More glitter. We'll come back to glitter later. But we've had a lovely voice note from Anjali who sent in this.
What advice would you give to someone who is newly diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer?
Oof. Okay. I was really lucky that when my breast surgeon said to me, okay, so last week I told you it was breast cancer in your breast, but today I need to tell you that it's actually in your spine as well, which makes it incurable. But he never said, that's it, your life's over, thankfully.
Wow.
I'm glad he didn't. I hope no one does that because that's such a shocking thing to hear. But I didn't ask him about my prognosis because I didn't really know the word that well. And I didn't really want to ask a question that I wouldn't fully understand the answer to. And maybe I was obviously scared to hear something that I didn't want to hear. So all I asked him was, is there anything that I can't do now? And he said, jump out of a plane. Just because your back is crumbly at the moment. So landing would just not be great. And I thought, oh, that's great. Because I wasn't planning on doing that anyway.
Phew.
And as I write in my book, I was so glad, and I don't think I realised this at the time, I only realised it when I was writing the book, is that he left this sort of window of opportunity or this window of like, anything can happen right now, open. He didn't direct me towards, like, this is how you're going to feel. This is the average survival of what's happening to you. He didn't give me any statistics, and I'm so glad he didn't. And also, then later on in that day, my friend said to me, you 23 when you got this disease, you already beat the odds. You already beat the statistics. You have every guarantee that that's going to happen again. In surviving it. And I'm glad I had a friend like that. So maybe say that to your friend or similar. And another thing that I had to tell myself quite a lot over the years, I guess because of that sense of, well, anything could happen because I got breast cancer at 23, is that everybody else's stories is not your story.
Yeah.
And hopefully that is reassuring for someone who's just now believes that their life is over, that this is all they're going to think about, the first thing they think about in the morning and the last thing they think about at night, and it's just not true. And if you, as a friend, believe that they are doing that, bring it up. And they might not be. They're like, well, actually, I was just thinking about how I'm going to get my kids to school tomorrow, or like, how I'm going to do this or that. And they might reveal something that might be really helpful for you to do for them. Because some people are really crap at asking for help.
Yes. Are you?
Yeah. I am. But I'm getting better. I'm definitely getting better. And it's
hard, isn't it?
It's just those, like, chores, house chores and stuff. Like, you just don't want to feel like someone else has to be your carer. But, like, caring's caring. Caring means someone gives a shit about you. So I just let them know. Quite like it.
I dreamed of having a fairy to come and clean my sheets when I had night sweats. But I think, God, no one would want to clean my dirty, sweaty sheets. But actually, they would if you asked them.
Okay, that is one thing I haven't asked my friends to do yet. And I'm having really...
Right, that's next on your list.
I need to ask them ASAP because I'm having really bad night sweats at the moment. I mean, if your friends do that, they'll do absolutely anything, won't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
A lot of people find that a cancer comes with black humour, and my friends couldn't believe the things I was coming out with. And given the title of your book, How to Glitter a Turd, was that true for you?
Yes. I think Copperfield actually made us become a lot more jovial and lighthearted about something. And that's not because we're not taking cancer seriously. It means that we can get breakthrough to an audience who won't necessarily listen to, you must check your breasts. Like, it matters how you, the words that you use.
Completely.
And I think glittering a turd kind of sums up me in a way.
Now, just for our listeners who don't know what a turd is, we might need to explain it.
Oh, it's a steaming poo. A poo of a situation that you can accept. You can't do anything about, but you can accept and then turn it into something brilliant, potentially, which I believe I did with my cancer. And I'm absolutely not saying that everyone should turn it into, you know, a crappy situation into a charity or some kind of lifelong purpose. But if you do, that's really great. And I'm not saying that suddenly every day should be brilliant and meaningful, but because I also believe in small wins too, small beautiful life things, and if you can notice those, then you're doing really great. But yeah, my turd was cancer, and I glittered it by finding a purpose I never thought I would, finding myself amongst it all. I mean, I know I was only 23 when I was diagnosed, so I was naive to think that I'd know all that stuff at 23 anyway. But, you know, cancer shone this massive light on a new Chris, a happier Chris.
Mm.
And I can't argue with it. I wouldn't change anything. Absolutely wouldn't change anything.
And I've read your book, and it gave me so much hope. Because I've been there. You think it's the end of the world, and it's odd to say that, like, I am a happier person, I'm a stronger person because of what cancer has taught me.
Yeah.
Now, I know the turd has grown recently, and a lot of listeners are sending you their love. They want to know, how are you doing physically and emotionally at the moment? Can you share a bit of that with us?
Absolutely. So my cancer over the years, kind of to fill in the gap, has spread to my my liver in 2011, and then my brain. My first brain tumour was in 2012. The second brain tumour was in 2014. And then in 2018, I got a real smattering of brain tumours, which I thankfully managed to get treated with really targeted radiotherapy to my brain called Gamma Knife, with a brilliant team in London at UCLH who believed in quality of life and really wanted to make sure I had that for as long as possible. And over the years, my cancer has progressed in the liver. It then spread to my peritoneum, and it had also gone to an adrenal gland, and I had to have a whole adrenal gland removed. And that's when they discovered that cancer had done something really clever and flipped from being hormone sensitive to triple negative, which
sneaky bugger.
But yeah, it likes to find new mutations, but it seems to move like a bit of a slug. Because given that I'm still here 14 years later, it's not the smartest cancer that you could ever find, because it would have outsmarted every single drug very quickly. And thankfully, my cancer didn't, or the treatment just happened to work super well. Some of them, not all of them. I know you're on palbociclib, and that really didn't do much for me.
Yeah.
So there's one chemotherapy drug, oral chemotherapy, called capecitabine, and that is the one that gave me the longest time just not having to be in hospital that much and just living life. So that was almost 4 years I got out of that. And then since then, it's kind of gone a bit more higgledy-piggledy. So I think my body is definitely starting to notice all these drugs that I've had over the years. And recently I got admitted to hospital with a neutropenic sepsis, which meant that my bloods were just not happy at all after the last round of chemotherapy. They bottomed out on literally almost everything, which meant I had to have two blood transfusions and a lot of antibiotics, like hardcore antibiotics.
Yeah.
And not just one type, because one type wasn't enough. They then had to move on to another one. I ended up being there almost 2 weeks. And thankfully, on the very last day, I said I'd really like to leave with some chemotherapy in my body. Because I was so scared that all that time, I wasn't having chemotherapy.
Yeah.
The cancer was just going, okay.
Yeah.
Her body is in a perfect condition right now to take over.
Let's go. Yeah.
And luckily, the drugs did work for me. And I could, on the last day, I also felt energetic again. I didn't feel like I just wanted to crawl everywhere.
Yeah.
I was given a low dose of chemotherapy and then I could leave the hospital. So I'm really glad about that. So I'm on a chemotherapy called eribulin at the moment, which I started maybe end of July.
Yep.
And I'm going to have a scan to see if it's done anything for my liver at the end of October, maybe early November. And I'm trying not to think about it till then. But in that time too, just after I had my funeral, which I guess we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, we're going to come to that later, definitely.
I found out that I had multiple brain tumours and that there was no longer the option to have them done, treated individually, so tactically in London. And my team there said, this is a whole brain radiotherapy situation now, where we treat the whole brain, the healthy bits too, but it means we get every single bugger that's in there. And you don't have to come to London for that. You can actually have that in Cornwall now. And I thought, I'm just going to check that they definitely have the best machines down here as well as in London.
Yes.
But they did. It's the same treatment. And the people that did it, the girls that looked after me for every single day of me being in there, were just magical. They made the whole situation so much better. So I had to go in for 10 days and have treatment to my brain. And it felt like someone was setting my brain on fire. The after effects was quite something for quite some time. And that's now thankfully calmed down.
It's a hell of a lot to go through.
Mm.
I think it's led a lot of my listeners to ask, how do you get the strength every day to wake up and live and to stay positive?
When I was in hospital, it was really hard because I hated it. I was starting to morph out of my own me, that everything felt like such an energy drain. That I was even in bed all day, like, that's not me. But I would go take myself a walk every single day to the maternity ward and stand outside the building and listen out for babies crying or mothers wailing. And every day I'd always have a friend with me in case I stumble because my legs were so weak. Still are at the moment, actually. But I just kept telling myself, it's not about what you can't do, it's about what you can do. It's not about what you can't do, it's about what you can do. And here I am, out in the fresh air. I can see trees, I can see green stuff. Not much, but hey-ho. And I can laugh with my friend still. So that's what I did, even when I was feeling really low. And now, not every day is easy. Not every day I jump out of bed and think, yeah, another day that I'm not dead, because I don't think that's sustainable. You know, I still have to go do the shopping and get some stuff into my fridge and into my belly. I still have to pay the TV license. You know, life goes on, and I'm kind of glad about that. The fact that life goes on is really reassuring for me because of what happens to me after I die. I want to see that life goes on. I want to see my friends succeeding in something or having a great holiday with their family. I want to see all that because that leaves me thinking, after I go, life goes on. So sometimes I do wobble. And recently I had a wobble where I just thought, cancer involves so much admin. I just can't do this alone. And because my brain is fried, literally fried, I'm worried that it can't all stay up there. Like, what drugs I'm taking, you know, who I'm reaching out to in terms of my team, like my integrative doctor team, booking blood tests, getting repeat prescriptions for stuff. I was like, this is so much. And I have the best, most wonderful twin sister called Maren. But she has a three-year-old. She's married. She's got all this shit carried on. I can't rely on her to do absolutely everything for me. And so I just thought, there's got to be people in this world, this sphere that I'm in the palliative care world, who could help me with this. And it's so weird. On the day that I really struggled, an email plopped into my email inbox from the person that kind of looks oversees the Southwest in terms of like at-home care and not just cancer care, but all kinds of care. And because I'd been helping them out with some end-of-life stuff that I got interested in after doing a doula course a couple of years ago. And she just popped in my inbox going, how are you doing? And I was like, "This, it's like you knew. It's like you knew that I needed to get...
Yeah.
I needed to ask you who I can speak to down here, who is the best and gets me. I don't want any horrible little platitudes about how well I'm doing and how inspirational I have for not being dead and things like that. I don't need that. I just need almost like a pal who's just like, oh, you need that drug? I'll call the GP for you.
Yeah.
Maybe if you need your PIP payment thing or your blue badge, I'll do that for you. Like, it was so good. I was like, you get paid to do that? That's so good. But not just that. The day I went into the hospital, Maren could call her and say, Chris is just not herself. And she's like, I've only met your sister twice, but the fact that she's still in bed by midday doesn't sound like her. I'm going to call the hospital now. I'm going to call the cancer ward now, the chemo ward, and talk about your symptoms.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got a bit of a temperature, and then I'll listen to what they say, and then we'll go with from there. And they said, come in immediately. And that's when I was admitted.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that she did, because we've never been in that situation before. We didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
In 14 years, I've never been admitted with an infection.
Really?
Yeah.
It's scary when it happens.
Yeah.
When I went in, I didn't pack a bag because, again, I'm not going to get an infection during chemo. I'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then your brain is fried and your husband doesn't know which pants you want to take in or where the phone charger is. It's like, oh, my God, where do I go?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling a bit better now.
I am so much.
I'm Vic Hope, and I'm the host of Bookshelfie, the podcast that asks women with lives as inspiring as any fiction to share the five books by women that have shaped them. From actors to politicians, writers, artists, fashion and interior designers, chefs, singers, and even a former Spice Girl, we have some incredible guests you do not want to miss. Join me on Thursdays for reading recommendations, intimate conversations, and a whole lot more. Listen and subscribe to Bookshelfie by the Women's Prize in partnership with Bailey's, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, another listener asked us, how do you calm yourself down when anxiety hits?
Good old breath work and taking a walk on the beach.
So do you swim in the sea as well?
Yeah. Not every day. I'm not one of those goddesses who goes in the cold water every single day. I'm not one of those, but I did go in this morning though. Yeah, I have big expanses to stare at. I'm so lucky down here in Cornwall to be able to do that. When I was waiting for my recent brain scan results to hear whether or not the whole brain radiotherapy worked, all the days preceding I was fine, and then the morning of, I knew they were going to call me at 3. I was literally catatonic. I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
But I just thought to myself, this is half a day of worry. Tomorrow will be better. It's got to be. The thing with me is like, as soon as I hear, if it's bad news, they usually follow up with a plan. And if I have a plan, I'm okay. But if I don't know, if there's this big fat unknown and my brain is going in all directions that I shouldn't do, then it's a real tricky thing. So as soon as I have it out with someone, I'm okay. But until that moment, all that morning, I was just like, nothing helped. Nothing helped. But I have a wonderful friend called Sophie Chu who had cancer as well a few years ago, and she's trained in breathwork now, and she's recorded some special breathwork sessions, and she sent them to me when I was in hospital, and they were so good. Just to be able to breathe. Tell yourself to breathe. Remind yourself to breathe. A big old breath is so great. And obviously, for me, it was even scarier in hospital because I had a lung infection, and I thought, breathing's really hard. Breathing's really scary. I hate that. It doesn't feel as easy as it used to. And now you're making me notice it even more by making me breathe.
Yes.
But I think it did expand how much air I could get in there. So I think do whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
If it's loll on the sofa all morning until you get some kind of results, or if you can, I mean, I say that. I have the luxury of doing that. Some people don't.
No.
Or distract yourself with people. So the weekend before that phone call, I was with friends, going in the sea, eating brunch and laughing a lot. And if you can surround yourself with that, things are going to feel lighter. And if you want to share your fears with them, do that. They probably don't know what you're going through.
Yeah.
Because how could they really understand?
Yeah.
But I don't know. Let them try. Let them try to understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do get asked that a lot about coping mechanisms. And it really is what works for you.
It is. And sometimes nothing works. You just have to get through that day.
I know.
But I think...
Yeah.
I like what you said about telling your friends. I'm very good at making the decision that they won't understand and not giving them that chance. And maybe opening up will actually help.
Yeah.
But now I want to come to the real elephant in the room for most people with cancer, and that's dying. My husband was in denial when mine came back, and he refused to accept that I might die before him. And it was a relief when we finally did our wills and our lasting powers of attorney. And seeing Mum die last Christmas was tough, and I wished she could have been at her funeral to feel all the love from her friends and family who she hadn't seen in years. Now, you've decided to do something about that. Can you tell us what you've done?
Yes. So I've been to my fair share of funerals in this time that I've had breast cancer.
Yeah.
And far too many of young women. And it was the last one I'd been to for my friend Sarah. And it was so her. It was so perfectly her. There was a disco. We all had to do shots of pina coladas and vow that we'd never forget her. And we had to say it out loud. And she had 10, the Sarah commandments for things that we had to do after she dies that she'd written up and it was printed out. Her casket had been painted with her pets, like guinea pigs and her dog.
Aww.
And all these beautiful things that her friends had done that she wouldn't have got to see. She wouldn't have been able to observe the room. But I hope she felt it wherever she was. That she was so loved and had so much fun in her life and such fun people in her life who just made her shine. So I felt so happy that she had such a great send-off, but also so sad that she hadn't been there. And every single person was like, Sarah would have loved this. Sarah would have loved this. Sarah would have loved this. And I thought, I don't think I could handle one more person telling me that, because I know. And so I had that firmly stuck in my mind. And I had done a death doula course online with an American university. Not because I thought I wanted to help people with their transitions or whatever at the end of life. It's just because I wanted to understand. I like to understand stuff before I experience it. So I wanted to understand end of life more and death and how people were helping guide people through that stuff. And again, that made me think, are we only ever going to talk about my death once I'm dead? Because I don't think that's healthy. And what I kept learning is the sooner you engage with your end of life, and also another great fact is the sooner you engage with palliative care, the longer you actually survive. Because they're teaching you not how to die necessarily, they're teaching you how to live. They're trying to help you with your quality of life. And if they could tweak that and make it better, obviously you're going to live longer. Makes so much sense. They're not here to go, right, let's get your deathbed ready.
Hook the drugs up, off we go.
Yeah.
It's not what they're there for, is it?
No, that's not what they're there for. Certainly not mine. I won't let her be. So I also did a mushroom trip. I'm a big believer in psilocybin and the research that they're doing in end-of-life care and helping people with eating disorders, PTSD, all these amazing things. A friend works in that kind of research field. And I'd already done a mushroom trip, and then I wasn't expecting that the next one I do would be me planning my entire funeral in 4 hours in my head.
Wow.
It was exhausting. And when I sort of came round from it, and it was a beautiful feeling, I just had to write it all down. I was like, okay, so apparently Dawn French has to be there, and I'm going to suspend my captain's ceiling, and all these things. I don't think I would have come up with some of the ideas that actually happened had I not had this amazing psilocybin journey. So after that, I wrote it all down, and obviously speak to Maren, and I said, oh, I need to do this. And even if I get challenged around, but you're not dead yet, or you're not looking like you're about to die, it's not about that. It's about celebrating all life, all the people's lives that are there, my life, and having the opportunity to show my gratitude for all of that. And it wasn't about someone just saying, Chris was really good at running a charity and all this stuff. Like, I didn't necessarily need to hear that. It was great when someone did go through my career, but it was about, she loves food. Like, she has such joy in her face when she eats food. Like, I was like, I love that you said that, because I do. I really love food. And it's all these little things that people had observed about me that they've never said, but they said that day.
I love that. Just being in a room full of love.
It was so powerful. It's like I was going to explode out of that cathedral. And I decided to do it in a cathedral because I'd actually been to the silent disco night / rave in that cathedral for New Year's Eve.
Wow.
A few months before. And I thought, this is such a beautiful building. I'm not religious, but this is such a beautiful building. And it honours such joy. Like, I just thought, I don't think you have to be religious to enjoy and really respect these ancient buildings. And so I thought, I think I want to have it there. I mean, it's just a cathedral. It's not like massive, is it? But I mean, it is. And so I started planning like locations, and but it's the Dawn French thing that I just thought, I've just got to ask her. I've just got to ask her if she'd come and be with Vicky Dibley. Yeah. And we'd met a couple of times already. She lives in Cornwall. She's wonderful. And I said, Dawn, I really need to ask you something. She's like, I really don't have time to meet you. I'm writing this book at the moment. But I'll happily do a Zoom chat with you. And as soon as the words came out of my mouth, I regretted it. And I just wanted to shut my laptop and go, I can't believe I've just fucking done that. I just sort of like, you know that emoji with the teeth? Like, that's how I was the whole time before she answered. I said, I'm organising my own living funeral and I'd love you to be there as a vicar of Dibley to do a skit. This is not you talking about my eulogy, because I have friends who are going to do that who actually really, really know me. And I'd hate to ask that of you because, you don't. And that would just be weird. But come and do a skit, lighten the mood. And she's like, you know, it's like illegal for me to pretend to actually be a vicar. I said, no, I don't need you to do a service. Absolutely not. I just need you to come and be funny and silly so that we all know that this is not deadly serious. Or this doesn't have to be, we don't have to be drowned in sadness today. We can be like soaked in joy. And so she was like, fuck it, I'll do it. And I was like, I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't believe it. She probably came off of that going, oh, what have I done? Because she gets asked to do, you know, come as Vicar of Dibley to stuff all the time. And it was one magical element of that day. It wasn't just the one, and she knows it. And there were so many magical moments that day. And I just felt so lucky and so exhausted having organized this thing for like 2 months.
Yeah.
It was incredible. And I worked alongside Legacy of Lives, who helped me basically fund it. And I didn't want to do it with a brand that I might have worked with before, because I wanted to shine a light on a really important cause.
Yeah.
And Legacy of Lives help you understand the importance of talking about funerals now. So there's no confusion. There's no family arguments when you die that obviously you wouldn't know about, but it happened to her family, and that's what made her create Legacy of Lives.
Mm.
And even more importantly, understand the cost of funerals. And that you don't have to go with the first quote that you get. And their website is super smart. You put in all your wishes and they help you see what's the cheapest on your high street, what might be the cheapest sort of national like co-op or whatever, and help you go down that route, because you don't have to just go to the first fusty looking funeral directors on the high street with dead flowers in the window. You can actually just do it online, or you can, with no rules to it, really. People think they have to be happening really, really fast. It has to involve a hearse. People have to be driven around in these awful cars. None of that is true. So I'm glad that Rebecca started Legacy of Life, so people understand that better and are better educated and hopefully feel lighter because of it.
Yeah.
So that was so great working with them. Yeah, it was brilliant. And, you know, it's been 3-4 months now since the funeral. And, yeah, it's so funny just thinking about some of the things that people have said to me, said in speeches on the day. And I think I'm still processing it, to be honest.
Yeah.
And living it still. So, yeah.
I've been to one living wake, and it was really weird. He'd had sarcoma and he was in his 60s, and it was really, really strange being in that room. But actually, I knew I wasn't going to see him again, but I saw him when he looked well and when he looked happy and he was surrounded by love. And it was just such a wonderful thing to do. And
yeah,
like, Mum never talked about her funeral. She said, "I'll know when I'm dying," and it was too late. And I think it's so important that you realise you can have what you like.
Yeah.
And you don't need to wait until you're gone to celebrate your life with the people you love.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you looked amazing. Can you tell us what you were wearing for the listeners who haven't seen the pictures?
It was actually a Cher-inspired jumpsuit with like tassely, silver tassely bits coming off it. And then my lovely friend Kay, who also did my eulogy, basically decorated a glittery jacket for me with the colours of the funeral, which are pink and lime green. No, not purple and lime green. And she'd customised it and made it look really extra. And on the back of my jacket, it said, "Yodo, you only die once."
Love it.
Yeah. I loved wearing that. That was great.
And you had glitter on your head as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I covered my entire head in glitter, which was fun to get off at the end of the night.
I bet. We need more of that.
Yeah. But I also wanted to mention that my oncologist was there.
And oh, how lovely.
Yeah. And I think since then things have, like, he gets things. I mean, I have him as my oncologist because he understands partnerships. He understands that what a patient means when they want to really concentrate on quality of life. He listens. He understands it. And I think he understands my quality of life more than most. And I hope it helps him in all future patient conversations and consultations where he just thinks, "What matters to you?" I want him to ask that question, "What matters to you?" And they can have those conversations about end of life, because I think a lot of oncologists are scared of having those conversations as well. And they're having them potentially too late.
I was, as a doctor.
Yeah.
You don't want to tell someone that they're dying, they're running out of options, so you avoid it. And I think we don't see what happens when someone leaves our clinic room. And for him to see what your life has been like, despite living with metastatic cancer, it's really going to make a difference.
Yeah.
For people listening, I think it is all about what matters to you.
Mm.
And you can say yes and you can say no to treatments, but you've got to put your life first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you can work on that relationship early, then when the time comes, you're not having to bumble through and kind of go, can you just be honest with me? You know, because it's so, I mean, when I say that so easily, but I'd be terrified to sit in front of someone and go, tell it to me straight. Is this treatment worth doing or can I go home, enjoy my life as long as possible, not attached to something in hospital? Is that worth doing? Should I be doing that?
Yeah.
And then whoever, might say yes or no. It's totally up to you. And then at least you know, he might be too scared to say, but at least you have gone there together.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he wrote, because I gave everyone the opportunity. I bought my cardboard casket already, mm-hmm. and I had it in the cathedral for people to write messages on. And, I mean, the more drunk people got, the more naughty it got. But thankfully, my oncologist wrote it early on in the night, and he wrote, you're not getting in here anytime soon. I'm going to try my best.
Love that.
Yeah.
Love that.
I'm very lucky.
Now, before we go, because I could speak to you for ages, and thank you so much for sharing your story and hopefully allaying some of the fears of anyone listening. But if there was one message you could give our listeners to help reassure them that what you think is the worst isn't actually the worst, what would it be?
Well, I thought having whole brain radiotherapy was going to be the worst of the worst. And I put that off for 5 years before I just couldn't go any further.
Wow.
But now that I'm here having this conversation with you about it has made me think maybe it wasn't the worst of the worst of the worst. And I think it would have been helpful to hear that as well from someone who's been through it. I think since that's quite fresh in my mind, I'm going to go with that.
Thank you so much, Chris, for being the guest today. It's been an honour to chat to you.
And you. Thank you.
That was the incredible Chris Halenga, founder of Copperfeel. And I don't know about you, but my brain is buzzing with ideas after listening to her speak. I want a living funeral and to celebrate my life with the people I love whilst I'm still alive. I'd love to know if you've been to one, or would you want one yourself? I think my takeaway for this week is that we all need to be more Chris and live life to the fullest. It's not about what we can't do, it's about what we can do. And she's shown us that even a stage 4 diagnosis doesn't mean you have to stop having fun. And now it's time for the final poem of this season with our podcast poet, the wonderful Donna Ashworth. I really hope that she's brought you joy over the last few weeks. Over to Donna.
I looked back. I looked back and saw beaches, sunsets, glasses clinking together, teeth shining in the light. I looked back and saw tables filled with food, bread broken in togetherness, hearts shedding tears, and so much laughter. I looked back and saw risks taken, hands squeezed, lessons learned, love flourishing. I looked back and saw tough times faced, problems shared, and triumphs hard won. I looked back and I didn't see my failures, my flaws, or my not being enoughness. I didn't see wrinkles, cellulite, or numbers on scales. I didn't see cars, possessions, or money made. I looked back and I saw a life filled to the full, lived to the full. And full includes the sadness, the loss, the living. Look back sometimes, my friends, if you can. It will remind you what is important, or perhaps, more importantly, what is not.
That was Donna Ashworth reading I Looked Back from her new book, Wild Hope. And I think that's my favourite poem from the season. What was yours? If you want to read more of Donna's work, or learn more about today's guest, Chris Halenga, with her book, podcast and charity, or you want to plan your own funeral or funeral with Legacy of Lives, you'll find all the details in the show notes. And if you've got a breast cancer question you want me to answer, please get in touch. And that brings us to the end of our first season of So Now I've Got Breast Cancer. I want to say thank you to all my brilliant guests, to our incredible poet Donna Ashworth, and of course, to you. Thank you for listening and for trusting me with all your questions and stories. I've really enjoyed making this, and it's been so moving to hear how the podcast is helping you, so keep your feedback coming. Whilst I'm prepping season two, I'm going to release some of my favourite interviews from my old podcast, Don't Ignore the Elephant, and I think you'll find them really useful. I'm Dr. Liz O'Riordan. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next year. So Now I've Got Breast Cancer is produced by Birdline Media.